Ukrainian-Russian forces battling it out for control of a key city in the east, while capital Kiev becomes the target of a fresh missile strike. North Korea conducts its largest single missile test ever after the U.S. deploys a nuke-powered aircraft carrier for 3 days of joint drill with South Korea. Tragedy in Bangladesh. Dozens dead, hundreds injured as a massive blaze burns through a storage facility overnight. Hey everyone, welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Bahram Sanjafi. Good to have you with us. As the Russian war in Ukraine grinds on, the eastern city of Severodonetsk has become the latest battle line in the conflict. The Ukrainian president says that clashes are being fought street by street. Volodymyr Zelensky says the situation remains extremely difficult in the strategic city. Cities in the eastern Donbass region are under constant airstrikes and artillery and missile fire, but Ukrainian forces, he says, are holding their ground. Severodonetsk is the last Ukrainian stronghold in the Lugansk region of Donbass. The war in Ukraine has taken a heavy civilian toll. In the latest such fatalities, at least 11 people were reported killed in the Lugansk and Donetsk regions in the southern city of Mykolaiv. Russian forces redeployed to eastern and southern Ukraine after pulling back from other areas, including around the capital. But missile strikes continue to rock Kiev. At least one person was hospitalized in the latest such explosion on Sunday. John Miller joined us earlier from the site of a fresh missile attack on the eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk, and he told us where the missiles were coming from and why.
I'm in a district of Donetsk. Last night, about 9 o'clock, the city was rocked by loud explosions. Over there, you might be able to see the Grad missile, which landed, burnt out buildings. Now, crying right now, last night and this morning, the constant sound of people sweeping up glass from their shattered windows. Right down there is the same scene as another rocket has landed. Now, scenes like this are nothing new in Donbass, but particularly around this area, it is new as people are walking around in disbelief about what's happened. The truth here in Donetsk is that the Ukrainian army has been shelling civilian areas, and it's been doing so for the last 8 years, targeting and killing its own civilians. Most people here in Donetsk say they no longer want to be part of Ukraine, and increasingly they want to join Russia. And this is one of the major reasons why of Ukraine shelling and killing its own people. Over 10,000 people have been killed in the last 8 years, over 100 children, a five-year-old girl was killed just a few days ago while she was sitting in her apartment watching TV. And it's a story here that's very important to be told in order to understand this conflict. If I was a journalist standing in the west of the country now, no doubt I'd be covering Russian strikes. But here in the east, in the separatist held areas, it's Ukrainian strikes. And it's increasingly some countries, at least behind the scenes, call for negotiation or for Ukraine to cede some territory. It's very important for the people here in Donbass and separatists here and why they rose up and why they continue to fight. It's very important for their views to be heard as well. Well, miraculously, nobody was killed in these strikes. There's reports of 10 people being wounded and one child. It happened about 9 o'clock, so most people were in their apartments. But that's a rarity. Almost every day here, people are killed by the shelling. It's not even really a story that journalists cover every day because it's just simply part of daily life. And incredibly, in the Western media, this story is not being told. Indeed, this has been going on for the last 8 years here in Donbass. It's a reason why, one of the main reasons why the separatists rose up and continued to fight. And as I said, their views, the people here, their views, and that fact, the Ukrainian army has been killing its own people for the last 8 years, that fact needs to be borne into mind. And it's very important to tell that story in order to understand why this conflict is happening.
Russian President Vladimir Putin says that Moscow is destroying U.S. weapons sent to Ukraine by the dozen. He was responding to a question about a U.S. decision to send new arms to Kiev. During the interview, Putin said that Russia is easily coping and targeting the shipments. Since the start of the Russian offensive in the Ukraine in late February, the U.S. has sent several armed shipments as part of a huge $40 billion in military and financial aid. Russia says the United States is seeking to wage a proxy war by supplying unprecedented military aid to Ukraine. North Korea has fired 8 short-range ballistic missiles toward the sea off its east coast. South Korea says the missiles were fired from an area of the North Korean capital. In recent weeks, North Korea has test-fired a range of ballistic missiles, including its largest intercontinental one. The latest one comes just a day after South Korea and the United States wrapped up their first combined military drills involving an American aircraft carrier in more than 4 years. North Korea has criticized their previous joint drills as an example of Washington's continued hostile policies toward Pyongyang, despite its talk of diplomacy. New Delhi has pumped more security forces in Indian-controlled Kashmir after a fresh spate of targeted civilian killings there. The main targets have been the minority Kashmir Hindus, known as Pandits, and the people who work closely with the government. A correspondent has more.
In the past week, Kashmir witnessed 2 targeted killings. A non-local bank manager from the western Indian state of Rajasthan and a Kashmiri Pandit school teacher. Fear has once again gripped the troubled valley region, and local minority Hindus, known as Kashmiri Pandits, fear a repeat of the 1990s scenario. Back then, the minority group left the valley region after a series of targeted killings of high-profile officials. At that time, full-blown insurgency against Indian rule had begun in Kashmir, and the Muslim-majority population was up in arms against the Indian rule and sought independent Kashmir or a merger with Pakistan. Scores of families who had returned to Kashmir Valley after a relief and rehabilitation package was announced by the Indian Prime Minister in 2010 are once again seeking an exit from the trouble-torn valley and blame the government for faking normalcy in Kashmir. Since the abrogation of Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in August 2019, there has been a sharp rise in attacks against Kashmiri Pandits and non-locals. In Muslim-majority Kashmir, for centuries, Hindus and Muslims have lived side by side in harmony. However, the political turmoil in the region in the early 1990s forced more than 250,000 Kashmiri Hindus to flee. Kashmiri Muslims support the return of Hindus to the valley, however, oppose the idea of separate settlements being given to them.
We are Kashmiri people. To us, Hindu and Muslim make no difference. We always want them to return and stay alongside Muslims. We are secure with each other.
Since Kashmir's special status was eroded in 2019, Prime Minister Narendra Modi's BJP government has implemented new laws and policies that local Muslims say aim to change the demographics of the region.
You cannot be ruled from the center, and that too in a sensitive area like Jammu and Kashmir. This has been an utter disaster and utter failure, not today, right from the time the governor's rule has been imposed here.
Kashmir Valley is the world's largest militarized zone. Estimates say more than 500,000 Indian soldiers are stationed in the valley. After the fresh spate of violence, New Delhi has ordered reinforcement ahead of the annual Hindu pilgrimage. Suspecting more targeted attacks, security has been beefed up in and around Kashmir. Amid mounting tensions, the Indian administration has denied the relocation demand of Kashmiri Hindus. However, fearing a repeat of 1990s, many have already started to flee the region, saying their lives matter and no politicking in the name of Kashmiri Pandits. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Now, thousands of Iranians have converged on the mausoleum of Imam Khomeini to mark the anniversary of the passing away of the late leader of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Yusuf Jalali has filed a report.
The father of the Islamic Revolution is how these Iranians remember Imam Khomeini on the 33rd anniversary of his passing. Congregating at his mausoleum in south of Tehran, Iranians once again paid tribute to Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic and the former leader of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, which put an end to centuries of autocracy in Iran. As with every year, incumbent leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, addressed the nation. Imam Khomeini passed away in 1989 at the age of 86, almost a decade after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, which saw the overthrow of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime in Iran, headed by Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, known as the Shah. Imam Khomeini spent many years in exile in Iraq, Turkey, and France, from where he led a swelling grassroots movement which ultimately ousted the Shah and led to the formation of the Islamic Republic, something which these people believe did not sit well with the West.
Imam Khomeini sought to free the country from foreign powers that had exploited our country's resources, including our oil. It's obvious that the revolution cut off the West's access to our resources, and that's why they've ever since been trying to deal a blow to the Islamic establishment.
People here view the revolution as an ideology, a legacy from Imam Khomeini that needs to be preserved against all odds, including the economic hardship that exists in Iran.
Inflation and high prices do exist here, which I hope will soon be solved, but this does not mean that we should abandon what we fought for back then. Our people gave blood to lead the revolution to victory, and we must preserve it.
We are the fourth generation of the Islamic Revolution, and we have come here to show the world that we will never turn our back on the revolution and our leader.
Imam Khomeini established the Islamic Republic following a referendum held in 1979, when, based on official reports, more than 98% of eligible Iranians voted yes to the Islamic Republic.
More than three decades after his passing, Imam Khomeini is still remembered as a man who changed the course of history in Iran, with ambitions for freedom and independence. People here believe his call for an independent Iran has been materialized, despite all of the economic and political pressures exerted by the West against Iran, which seek to isolate the Islamic Republic. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The death toll from a fire and explosion at a shipping container depot in Bangladesh has hit 34. At least 300 people have also been injured, some of them critically. Casualty figures are expected to rise as firefighters are trying to bring the flames under full control. The blaze broke out late Saturday at a container storage facility in a town some 40 kilometers from the key port city of Chittagong. Emergency crews were working to extinguish the fire when a massive explosion rocked the site. Turkey is gearing up for another major incursion into northern Syria territory despite international outcry. Ankara has in the past launched several offensives in the war-ravaged Arab country under the pretext of fighting Kurdish militants there, but this time Turkey's ties with the U.S. and Russia are at stake.
Tensions are once again rising in northern Syria as Turkey threatens to conduct a major military operation there. Ankara says it wants to establish a 30-kilometer safe zone along the Syrian border and push back terrorists. Turkey has long been fighting members of the People's Protection Units, YPG, a U.S.-backed Kurdish militia it deems a terrorist group. Since 2016, Turkey has carried out three major incursions inside the Syrian territory under the same pretext, the latest of which came in October 2019, which fell short of ending in creating the buffer zone Ankara was hoping for. In the meantime, Damascus has slammed the Turkish plan as an act of aggression and an extension of Ankara's policy of ethnic cleansing in the area.
Turkey has been notorious for smuggling oil and engaging in oil theft in Syria. It has been launching military operations into Syria. It is indeed shot down and killed Russian military members in Syria. So Turkey has ambitions to expand its political footprint and reconquer parts of Syria that it lost after World War I in the Sykes-Picot Act, which the French and the British carved up the Middle East after World War I.
Syria says the measures taken by Turkey have caused civilian casualties and done massive damage to public and private property, including critical infrastructure. Syria describes Turkey's offensive as a shameful act of aggression that has displaced dozens of families from their homes and villages.
Turkey's planned measure comes as Russia has withdrawn a significant number of its troops from Syria amid the war in Ukraine. Ankara may be planning to fill that vacuum, but how can it justify its presence in Syria when it doesn't have the approval of the Damascus government to station its troops? The Syrian government has repeatedly slammed Turkey for its military move in northern Syria.
Russia has urged Turkey to refrain from launching an offensive into northern Syria, saying it could lead to a dangerous deterioration of the already difficult situation. Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman said such a move would be a direct violation of Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Maria Zakharova added that an incursion by Turkey could cause a further escalation of tensions in Syria. Iran's foreign ministry made a similar statement warning of humanitarian disasters and heightened tensions in the region. Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said while the Islamic Republic understands Turkey's security concerns, the only way to alleviate those concerns is through dialogue and respect for bilateral agreements with neighbors. Turkey's face-off against the YPG would put Ankara in an uneasy position with the United States, which considers the Kurdish militia a major ally inside Syria. U.S. State Department on Tuesday said Washington condemns any escalation and supports the existing ceasefire lines in the area.
Well, the United States certainly has backed the Kurdish operations to carve up Syria, to carve up Iraq, to basically split, divide, and conquer that whole region into ethnic strife and competition. That is one of the sore points between the U.S. and Turkey is the Kurds, because Turkey sees them as an enemy to be destroyed, whereas the U.S. sees the Kurds as a pawn, as a tool to use in destabilizing Syria, President Bashar Assad, and create endless civil war and conflict there.
Russia, Iran, and Turkey are the guarantors of the Astana peace process and have been mediating peace negotiations between the Syrian government and the opposition since 2017. Any rifts between the three could derail the talks and damage any progress they have achieved.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Listeners Special. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warm greetings to you all. Welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special on this Sunday, June 5th, 2022. I'm Atefeh Irfani, hosting this program today. Dear listeners, I do express my condolences on the 33rd passing away anniversary of the founder of the Islamic Revolution, late Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, which was yesterday on June 4th. And today, as you know, is June 5th, and this day marks the anniversary of June 5th Uprising 1963, which sparked developments which led to the victory of the Islamic Revolution 15 years later. Condolences to you all on these two anniversaries. Reception reports from around the world, as well as emails and letters, which I mention some of their names, and later during the program, I will read these great emails from our dear listeners from around the world. Here we've received reception reports from Mizanur Rahman, one of our old and regular listeners from Bangladesh. Also, we've received a reception report from Han Hardong from the Netherlands, as well as a reception report from Howard Barnett from England, one of our old and regular listeners. Of course, we've received many emails from around the world, including an email from Hitoshi Sugio from Japan. Konstantin Provatoro from Ukraine has sent us an email. Bill McDavid from the US has sent us an email. Hasna Manzil from India and Pratima Behakat from India have sent us emails. Thank you very much for being with us. After a short break, I will read these great emails from around the world. Stay with me. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, your program. And as I said, Hitoshi Sugio from Japan has sent us an email. Let's see what Hitoshi says. Dear IRIB English Radio staff, my name is Hitoshi Sugio. I am 51 years old and I work in a municipality here in Higo, Japan. I have received your program and I would like to give you a report and listen to your English program at home. Signal was very weak and I had difficulty to understand the program. I'll conclude my reception report. If you confirm the details of my report is correct, I request you to send me your verification card or letter to my address in Japan or by email. Thank you in advance. Salam and warm greetings to you, Hitoshi Sugio from Japan, and many thanks for sending us this email. As your request for sending you a QSL card, my colleagues in IRIB English Radio will soon send you an EQSL card as a verification. You gave us some information about the quality of the program. As you said, in your region, the signal was very weak and you had difficulty to understand the program. I will inform my colleagues about this problem, and our technicians and engineers soon will fix the problem you had in your region. Hitoshi Sugio from Japan, why don't you tell us which program or programs you like the best? Tell us your views about our programs. And if, at times, if you had difficulty in listening to the programs for a short time, for a temporary period, you can refer to our website at www.parstoday.com/en, and you can catch up the programs you like. And after we fix the problem, you can refer to the traditional kind of listening to the radio, I mean the shortwave. Anyway, thank you very much for writing to us and telling your views about the quality of the programs. Write to us soon. We are looking forward to hearing from you soon. And let's see who has written to us. Yes, from India, Hasna Manzil, one of our regular listeners, has written to us in an email. Hasna Manzil says, "Dear friends at IRIB English Radio, I am a listener of world radios, and this time I had a chance to listen to IRIB English Service based in Tehran, Iran. I would love to listen to your radio regularly too, so please send me the frequency guide of your station with complete details of the programs. I shall be very grateful if you do it." Hasna Manzil from India, Salam from Tehran, Iran, and IRIB English Radio, please accept our appreciations for sending us this email. So you listen to world radio programs, and this time you listen to IRIB English Radio, and that's great. Hasna Manzil, as for your request about sending you the frequency guide, the frequency guide is available at our website at www.parstoday.com/en, and there you can find the frequency schedule and frequency guide. Because at the time of the pandemic, sending any material on behalf of IRIB English Radio to our great listeners is not possible. So you can refer to our website to find our frequency schedule or frequency guide. But for the time being, please accept our EQSL card. Anyway, thank you very much for sending us this email. Write to us soon, Hasna Manzil from India. So after a short break, I will be back with other emails from around the world. Stay with me. Welcome back. Here we have an email from Ukraine from Konstantin Provotorov, one of our old and regular listeners. So Konstantin says, "Dear friends, greetings from Ukraine. I have had great pleasure in logging your station and sending you my reception report, trusting that you will be in a position to verify it. Would you be kind enough to send me your EQSL card? I enclosed audio files recording your broadcast. Thank you for your previous replies." Salam and warm greetings to you, Konstantin Provotorov, and thank you very much for writing to us, writing to your radio, IRIB English Radio. Yes, my colleagues will soon send you an electronic QSL card as a verification. And we've received your audio file recording, IRIB English Radio broadcast. Konstantin Provotorov, write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English Radio programs. So here we have another email from India from Pratima Bahakat. So Pratima Bahakat from India says, "Dear IRIB English Radio friends, my name is Pratima Bahakat from Foreign Radio Listeners Club based in India. We would appreciate it if you can send us your current printed schedule, some souvenirs, stamps, and small gifts if possible. Please keep sending your newsletter." Salam and warm greetings to you, Pratima Bahakat from India. Please accept our warm gratitudes and appreciations for sending us this email. So you are from Foreign Radio Listeners Club based in India. We're so happy that the signals of IRIB English Radio are received in your region and in your country, India, and in your Foreign Radio Listeners Club, which is based in your country, India. For your request, as I have mentioned several times during our programs in Listeners Special, sending any material, any souvenirs, promotional items of IRIB English Radio at the time of pandemic is actually not possible. Maybe after the pandemic, we can get back on our track in sending our great listeners the souvenirs of IRIB English Radio, but at the time, just please accept our electronic QSL card. And after the pandemic, as I said, we will get back on track and send our listeners the souvenirs of IRIB English Radio. As for the, you know, frequency schedule, you can refer to our website at www.parstoday.com/en. Pratima Behakat from India, write to us soon. We are looking forward to hearing from you soon and also from your foreign radio listeners club. Thank you again. So after a short break, I will be back with another email. Stay with me. So the last but not the least is an email from Bill McDevitt from the US. So let's see what Bill says. Greetings from Florida. Thank you very much for the verification card, QSL card you sent. IRIB English Radio has very beautiful cards, quite impressive. I enjoy your daily broadcast on 9855 kHz when conditions are favorable for reception. I most enjoy your listeners' special segment of your program. Also, would suggest you to present your local news and weather. It is always interesting for listeners to hear cultural stories about your local area. Again, many thanks for the QSL card and please keep up the good work. Best regards, Bill. So, salam and warm greetings to you, Bill McDevitt from the US. And many thanks for sending us this email. Yes, my colleagues send our great listeners EQSL cards as a verification. And we are so happy that you're enjoying the segment of our program. I mean, listeners especially, it's great. It's an honor that we hear the news of support and commitment to our program, listeners especially, and of course, to our radio, IRIB English Radio. If you're interested in listening stories and series about the culture of Iran, you can refer to different programs we broadcast at a time. For example, we have a program about the tourist attractions of Iran, which is called Close Up Iran. You can refer to this program, which is broadcast on Mondays. Yes, on Mondays, you can listen to this program. And the details of this program, the frequency, is available at our website at www.parstoday.com/en. And we have, at this website, we have the archive of our past programs about cultural stories. There you can find many different programs about the culture of Iran. Yes. Thank you very much, Bill McDevitt, for sending us this email and reflecting your views about our programs. Write to us soon, Bill, and tell us your views about other programs of IRIB English Radio. Welcome back. Here we wrap up this week's edition of Listeners Special. Please keep in touch with us and have a good time.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to englishradio@irib.ir. That is one word, englishradio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Once again, our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Iran's foreign minister says his country will immediately, effectively, and proportionately respond to any political move against Tehran by the United States and its allies at the International Atomic Energy Agency. Hossein Amir Abdollahian censured the, quote, hasty and destructive move by Washington and the three European countries, namely Britain, France, and Germany, in compiling a draft resolution at the IAEA. Elsewhere, the Israeli Prime Minister steps up his rhetoric against Iran as he hosts the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, just 4 days ahead of the IAEA Board of Governors meeting on Iran. The Israeli regime has said it will take action if the international community fails to stop Iran's nuclear program within, quote, the relevant time frame. The rhetoric comes despite repeated warnings by Iran against any Israeli act of aggression.
This is the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA. The Vienna-based agency is supposed to monitor compliance with the 1968 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The NPT has been described as the centerpiece of global efforts to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons, promote cooperation in the peaceful uses of nuclear energy, and to achieve the goal of nuclear disarmament. The IAEA is supposed to have technical and professional cooperation with NPT signatories away from politics. The Atomic Agency has had a high-profile role regarding Iran's nuclear energy program. In 2015, when Iran and the P5+1 struck a deal known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the IAEA was tasked with monitoring Iran's compliance with the terms of the agreement. As the fate of the faltering 2015 deal remains increasingly unclear, the technical role and supposed independence of the atomic watchdog are being tested. Back in March, Rafael Grossi, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, visited Iran. The IAEA and Iran announced at the end of the visit that they had agreed on an approach for resolving remaining bilateral issues. The visit came as representatives from Iran and the P4+1 were trying to find a way to move forward in their negotiations aimed at reviving the 2015 deal. The talks are currently stalled, with Iran saying the United States is failing to make necessary political decisions. At this point, any stance by the Atomic Agency could have an important effect on the stalled talks. This week, Iran's top diplomat said Tehran and the agency's agreement in March was mutually satisfactory. He warned that political interference in the technical affairs of the agency is totally unconstructive. Amir Abdollahian's comments came ahead of a meeting of the IAEA's Board of Governors scheduled for June the 6th. Days left to the meeting, the IAEA chief has arrived in Israel after Tel Aviv released documents alleging Iran spied on the IAEA. Iran says Israel, which has refused to join the NPT and is believed to possess hundreds of nuclear warheads, hates the JCPOA and wants to derail the effort to revive it.
The problem with much of what the International Atomic Energy Agency has been doing is that it is trying to find excuses to really, I suppose, make out that the Iranian nuclear program is a military program. And what one of the problems with the IAEA is they're not looking anywhere near as closely at the Israelis, who do have nuclear weapons. They tried to keep it secret, but Mordecai Vanunu blew the whistle in the Sunday Times here in Britain back in the 1980s and did a massive jail term for his when he was kidnapped, actually, for his trouble. That they do have many nuclear weapons, probably something like 200, they say.
Reports say the United States and its Western allies, pushed by Israel, plan to pile pressure on Iran at the upcoming IAEA meeting. Tehran has warned that it would respond firmly and appropriately to any such move because Tehran has been cooperating based on the agreement reached in March. The fate of months of negotiations between Iran and the P4+1 seems to be at stake as a meeting of the IAEA Board of Governors draws close.
Well, joining us on Spotlight, we have journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joining us from San Remo. And also journalist and political analyst Seyed Mohsen Abbas, who's joining us from Islamabad. Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Magnier in San Remo. Cooperation between Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency is under the spotlight. Tehran has criticized the recent Nuclear Watchdog's report as being unfair. And in continuation, the Iranian Foreign Ministry said the report does not reflect the realities of the talks between Tehran and the IAEA. How did this report materialize, and given previous cooperation between Iran and the IAEA, would you agree with Iran's assessment of the nature of this report?
Well, first of all, Iran has been showing an extreme generosity with the IAEA, with the U.S., and with the European country, mainly here France, Britain, and Germany, who none of these countries ever was committed to the nuclear deal since 2018 when President Donald Trump shredded the deal. Therefore, the position of Iran is too soft, in my opinion, in showing that overture to the West and allowing the IAEA to come in and inspect the nuclear site and to hear these countries who never acknowledge and abide by the nuclear deal since 2018 and to accept their criticism and their demands. So this is something very weird that's happening. First of all, the U.S. and the European need to abide by their commitment and to regain the JCPOA that was signed in 2015. And stop fiddling around with all the excuses just to delay the signature. Secondly, I think when the IAEA visit Israel, that is not party of the NPT and has never accepted the IAEA safeguards or on some of its main principal nuclear activities, and is widely known to possess dozens or hundreds of nuclear weapons, is again a behavior from the West that is totally unacceptable. And I'm very surprised how Iran is tolerating all this behavior and waiting for the West to abide by something that they show the lack of responsibility and lack of commitment and lack of truth in what they are saying.
Seyed Mohsen Abbas, do you see an Israeli role in the recent IAEA report on Iran? If so, what message does the IAEA chief Rafael Grossi's visit to Israel send at this point in time as Israel has stepped up its campaign to get the West on board to pile more pressure on Iran? Let's not forget that Israel has always been an adamant opponent of the JCPOA.
Well, first of all, let's tie up who all these guys are. Who is the IAEA? Who are the United States? And who is Israel? I mean, the reality is there's no real difference. They all answer to one master, and that happens to be the moneylender, usurer mafia, which not only controls the American Fed, but it also would dictate what the IAEA does, who's in that actual organization. And in fact, of course, these people are all very much the people who are right at the heart of maintaining Israel as an illegitimate entity that creates conflict through its Yinon plan in the Middle East. So it is frightfully confusing to even imagine why anybody would wonder at the IAEA turning up in Israel and going and presumably getting their orders from the Zionist networks there as to what they should do next. I mean, it's quite laughable, really, to say that they're in any way impartial. They aren't impartial. These organizations at an international level, mostly whether they're the UN, whether it's these guys at the IAEA, or it's the WHO, most of these institutions are funded by either the US, its kind of partners, or their partners in global corporate money mafia. So I'm afraid the Iranians do know this. I'm pretty sure that Amir Abdullahian and the crew who are negotiating know exactly what's going on. They're playing, I think, a long-term game. They can't do any worse than they are at the moment with the kind of sanctions that they've had imposed steadily to the level of really the worst kind ever imposed on any nation at any time in history. So if they carry on with this process of a JCPOA, at least I guess it means that there isn't going to be a military option that's taken into account. So maybe they're just playing along with things at that level. But also don't forget, in the negotiations, Israel would be stipulating very much so that the Islamic Republic of Iran should make major concessions in the way it operates in the region. So with its resistance front, which is undeniable, there in Yemen, there in Palestine, there in Lebanon, there in Syria, there in Iraq, what they're actually scared of is Iran being able to maintain a resistance against the Zio-American hegemony. And to that end, what they want is the IRGC to continue to be sanctioned. And the Iranians have made a specific point of saying, look, you've got to lift all the sanctions on the IRGC. And that is one of the major sticking points. And I think that's what the Westerners are essentially trying to scratch their heads to see how they can get around that. I think there's a lot of brinkmanship and there's a chess game going on. The Iranians have been around for a lot longer than the Americans, let's put it that way. And they know how to play these games over a long period. So the JCPOA duration is a mere drop in the ocean of time as far as Iranian diplomacy is concerned.
Sure. Elijah Magnia, Iran has slammed Rafael Grossi's visit to Israel as Naftali Bennett hosted Grossi just days ahead of the IAEA Board of Governors meeting on Iran. Tehran says that Grossi's visit contradicts the agency's impartiality and it undermines its technical and professional status. The question is, why is the IAEA chief in Israel? And while the Israeli regime itself is a violator of the IAEA's rules.
Indeed, we've seen how not only Grossi visiting Israel, but also the Americans and the Europeans who are going to Israel to convince or to bring in the Israelis and to stop them from doing any action that they cannot do on their own. They need the support of the Americans to do any military action against Iran. And to go to Israel, it shows that it is the opinion of the Israelis matter to the Americans and to the European, and above all, to the IAEA, which is really a very surprising and unusual to go to Israel and seek its approval or its blessing, or to convince the Israelis about JCPOA, because at the end of the day, we heard from the Israelis and from the Europeans and the Americans that it's much better to have a JCPOA in place rather than seeing Iran reaching the 90% percentage of the uranium, and that is the military grade. And I think Iran is not doing enough to make sure that these people are scared, and that is not waiting just for them to approve, because at the end of the day, President Joe Biden has been in power for the last almost 2 years and is not doing enough to push the JCPOA. So going backward and forward to Israel and to hear the Israeli empty threats against Iran and their reaction that maybe they will attack, maybe not, all that is pretty annoying when the JCPOA is straightforward and the Americans should just sign what they have revoked in 2018.
Said Mohsen Abbas, staying on that topic, why would the IAEA want to cooperate with a regime that has openly admitted to nuclear sabotage, terrorism, and assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists?
Basically, because the Rothschilds who created Israel, along with the West, from day dot, have been behind this project. They've been behind this project, which primarily was supposed to act as a policeman for them in West Asia while they plundered the oil. And that's exactly what they've done for over 7 or 8 decades, perhaps more. But, of course, Israel is really... part of a system, part of a network, which is very much united. It is the Zaire Western Empire, and they operate in lockstep. And the reality is that now Iran is probably, alongside Russia, of course, probably the key protagonist, the key, if you like, problem for the Zaire American Empire's dominance of certainly West Asia. And let's not forget, whoever dominates West Asia, and this is historically a fact, whoever dominates that middle part of the world, that patch, essentially becomes the dominant world force. And so, of course, they're not going to, the Zaire Americans aren't going to let go of West Asia that easily. Of course, Iran is also now probably banking on the fact that the Russians have got the Americans distracted, or NATO and the rest of their Atlantic allies, if you like, distracted over in Ukraine. And perhaps what they're also thinking is that Biden is therefore necessarily weaker at the moment, and they can drive home a hard bargain. Essentially, if Trump, for instance, was to come back in a couple of years, there's a lot less of a chance of a deal being struck. So I think that perhaps the Iranians are just simply looking at this as an opportunity, that if they give the Americans time, eventually they'll commit. But the reality is that even if Biden committed to the JCPOA in its original form, if he was to allow the IRGC also access to doing business as usual again, what's the guarantee? What's the guarantee for Iran that America won't renege on the treaty overnight again, say if Trump was to come in, or another individual altogether? What is the guarantee? There is none. I don't think there's any way the Iranians can guarantee that. So what we're seeing is really just a game that's being played out. In the meantime, the time that the Iranians have been buying themselves, they've accelerated in making ballistic missiles, in learning the art of war, the art of defense, and they've created allies in the region and created much greater resistance economy and are able to operate as an independent sovereign nation, providing their own facilities, their own skill sets, their own industries across a whole swathe of activities. So I think this is the time is on the side of the Iranians, as far as I see.
Mr. Magni, in San Remo, Iran has censured the, quote, hasty and unconstructive move by the U.S. and the three European countries, ones that we mentioned earlier. Do you believe that with the threat of an anti-Iran resolution at the IAEA, in fact, the U.S. is seeking to pressure Tehran to return to the JCPOA without its key demands being accepted?
Well, it's basically up to Iran to decide which move it wants to adopt. What the U.S. and the IAEA and Europe with it are trying to put pressure on Iran, knowing that the Iranian may be more flexible. It's up to Iran to stand by its position and to make sure that its demand will not move from its demand, because removing the IRGC is essential for Iran, because the IRGC is not only military, but it's also a civilian organization. And imposing sanctions on the IRGC means allowing the U.S. and Europe to keep the door open to other sanctions under the title of imposing it on the IRGC, which means renewing all the 1,600 sanctions in a different form under different titles. So what the Americans and the West is trying to do is to impose on Iran to keep the to accept that the IRGC remains on the list of terrorism. Like that, it means the door open to more sanctions. And Iran understood that it is the pressure from the IAEA at the end of the day will do nothing if Iran reject it. And the IAEA will have to choose another road that is more closer to Iran and what Iran may agree to continue respecting the JCPOA once everybody else respects the JCPOA. And this is not imposed only on Iran to abide by the IAEA and everything else that comes with it. It is up to the other states who are not respecting it to show their goodwill.
Sayed Mohsen Abbas, Tehran has repeatedly warned that the IAEA's work must remain technical and away from politics and avoid any political interference in its technical affairs. In summation of what we discussed tonight and recent developments are all pointing to the exact opposite, aren't they?
Well, I think the warnings have certainly been coming thick and fast from the Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Baghir Ghani and other quarters as well, and they've made it very clear that with all the saber-rattling that Israel's been doing, because don't forget, Israel's just been on a major aerial exercise, military exercise in Cyprus, where they've been practicing the bombing of Iranian nuclear sites. So, you know, there's been several things going on alongside the JCPOA dialogue at the moment, or the lack of, more to the point. But, at the end of the day, Israel's been given fair warning that nothing is going to stop the Iranians to actually go ahead with a nuclear program, which is peaceful, number one. Nothing will stop the Iranians from continuing to back the IRGC and its own military to defend the sovereign interests of Iran, not only in Iran, but in the region, because that's the way nations operate. It's America, which is actually way outside of its kind of region and remit. And so anything that happens in terms of Iranian military, cessation or backing down in the region would have to really see huge reciprocity from the Americans. And they're not going to do that overnight, certainly not with Israel egging them on. Israel can't, as a military unit, to be honest, even take on Hezbollah and Hamas, it seems, these days, let alone take on the might of Iran and the various other resistance fronts. If that war eventually happens, it doesn't look like Israel fancies that war, so they end up with all this saber-rattling, these threats, and the pushing of America to take a more robust stand. America doesn't seem that keen on making robust stands these days either. However, these things are never predictable, and at the moment what the Iranians are showing is a firm commitment to their continued efforts in West sure. Asia to secure their interest and to help the oppressed in that region, and that can make sure there's a continued clash with Israel and Zio-American interests.
All right, that's all the time we have for the show. Thanks to our guest, journalist and political analyst Elijah Magni, joining us from San Remo, Italy, and also thanks to journalist and political analyst Sayed Mohsen Abbas with us from Islamabad, and a special thanks to you all for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is IRIB English Radio.